rescue attempt?
Might be.
Yes.
Supposed to be Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to the final Film Fight Club of 2018. It has been a wonderful year sharing films and fighting with everyone. We'll be back next year, but it is our final show.
It's the only show in Sydney that's looking out for you if you enjoy watching films and also picking on random strangers,
the final
punching people
countdown.
In the face, and all of these other lovely activities.
That's what we encourage at all.
The final countdown.
So this is our fun fact. This is our 53rd show for the year. We did 53 shows this year because there are 53 weeks in 2018.
Wow. That's an odd number of weeks. Isn't there 52 weeks usually?
Not in 2018, apparently.
Because it had a leap year? Is that why?
I think that's it. Yeah, we'll go with that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So this has been Glenn Falkenstein, Falcon Screen, and we have freelance writer and critic, Virat Nehru.
Our very own David Stratton, thank you.
And we have Chris Evans from all things about town and place and
suburbs.
Everywhere. That's Chris.
We actually started recording this show earlier, and Glenn made an obscure reference to the joke we used in the previous attempt to record this episode.
And so
he's nice.
That's a little bit of a glimpse behind the curtain of how the Film Fight Club magic is made.
It's like the pilot for Game of Thrones. It's just never ever going to be seen. So,
Talking about Game of Thrones, actually, George R. R. Martin. I'm not sure if he's going to actually finish the book before
he's not going to finish.
I actually just bought the history of Westeros, the Aegon's conquest and 300 years prior to Robert's rebellion in Castlemaine. I'm looking forward to reading it.
I think if he finishes the series, it'll be a miracle. Each book takes longer than the last one, and he's not even sure he can wrap it up in two.
As the saying goes,
going to finish.
You know, you finish the series, the fifth series finishes you, eventually.
Well, I look forward to more Game of Thrones, as do the prisoners in Logan Lucky. Very funny. Yeah. But then we're not talking about Logan Lucky this week. We are having our second Netflix special. Earlier in the year, it was our third episode. We talked about all the things that were screening on Netflix, and we are doing that again now.
We promise not to take the piss out of Netflix and be nice to them, in this episode at least, even though we hate...
They're doing a lot of good... What do you mean? They're doing great stuff.
We hate in general, but we don't hate Netflix.
Exactly. I just think...
We hate.
That
can be our tagline.
That's
Film Fight Club. We hate.
It's like, my favorite line of Dodgeball was like, just remember our motto, aim low. Right. And we're just like, we hate.
Yep.
Netflix are doing great stuff, including Roma, which is currently screening on Netflix, the best thing on Netflix right now.
Also,
you can see that before you see anything we're about to discuss later in the episode.
Hopefully still playing in cinemas from tomorrow. Otherwise, run out and catch it in the late show tonight. A few cinemas are still playing it.
Yeah, honestly, it deserves a big screen experience. I mean, otherwise, just hook up your phone or your laptop into a TV or a bigger screen.
See it on the largest screen you can. As the Netflix CEO is suggesting, watch it on your phone.
Exactly.
No.
Or better still, we'll give you Will Wong's address. Go to his house and watch it in a 4K projector. That's the closest.
Shout out to Will. We're not doing that.
No, okay. But if you do want it, let me know and I'll ask Will and he'll arrange something.
Virat's pushing
into territory that he's not permitted, I think, to be broadcasting about on the radio.
No, it's fine.
We'll not do it.
We'll not do it. Clarifying, I'm not.
So just send us a message.
Look, if you absolutely can't see Roman the big screen, then get in touch with us and we'll make it happen. So Roman is the best thing on Netflix right now, but there are other films which we'll be talking about in the course of this program. Again, our last for the year, including The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the new film by the Coen brothers, Hold the Dark, starring Alexander Skarsgård and Riley Coe and a number of others. The second season of The Sinner, fast one of my favourite new shows. Shirkers, Mowgli, not The Jungle Book. Mowgli, yes, there was that other one which Netflix bought up. They were produced around the same time. And Cam.
One was delayed forever.
Yep, Cam, the new Blumhouse film. And The Other Side of the Wind, which Orson Welles, several decades after he has passed away, has managed to release to his great credit.
Return from the Dead.
Good work, Orson.
So the first film we will be talking about is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It is an amalgam of six anthology films set in the post-war era.
You mean it is one anthology film amalgamating six stories?
Which is exactly what I meant to say.
It's yes. Okay. I'm sure yes. the listeners got it.
Yeah. There are six stories in this movie. Yes. And it is set in the immediate post-Civil War West. And it stars a number of Coen Brothers favorites and excellent character actors. The films, for me, vary in terms of quality. The actors do not vary in terms of quality. They're all excellent. These two know, Joel and Ethan, know how to pick their performers. What did we think of The Ballad of Buster Scruggs?
I thought this was really strong. I think there is always going to be variance in how much a story grabs you when it comes to anthology films. But there is that variance here. But I think the quality of every story is at a high enough level that the variety kind of compensates a little bit for some of the dips in quality. I was always interested in these films, and when they weren't so interesting, they had the good sense to end fairly quickly. The longest story in here is the best.
I'd agree with that. The ones that are the one-joke ones are wrapped up pretty summarily, including the James Franco one, which I think really is just about the final line, which has been carried very strongly in the promotional material.
It is, but that...
And a reworking of Maverick, by the way.
It still featured some excellent action and comedy.
Oh, the scene where he's running off to him at the well.
Incredible.
Oh, that was brilliant.
The Coen brothers, as directors right now, I think are at the top of their game. I think this film is much better than Hail Caesar.
I'd agree.
Oh, yeah, totally. Easily.
But
once again, I think Chris and I are in agreement very easily. And
these days,
Glenn seems to be the... Divergent.
I was a Simple Man fan.
Serious Man?
Serious Man. What did I say?
Simple Man.
Oh dear. Serious Man.
You are a pretty simple man.
Oh, that's. Right? I was thinking you're single. Wow. That's harsh.
Very very special. You know, heartwarming holiday episode of Film Fight Club.
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holidays, everyone.
Yep.
Okay. So, talking about a serious man. Yeah.
All of these stories are fairly dark and cynical. But I think the Coen brothers managed to vary their approach to that enough that it doesn't just become depressingly one note. Some of the, you know, the first two stories approach their sort of bitter outcomes through the lens of comedy.
And the third.
Yeah. The third.
The Liam Neeson one.
Yeah. There is comedy in that, but it's getting darker and bleaker.
As the stories progress, they do take, you know, the tragic comedy gives way to some actual tragicness, I guess.
And that's right. And the fourth one gives more notes of lightness, I think. They knew when to switch tone so the thing didn't become overbearing.
That had my favorite scene of the whole film with the prospecting. That was
Tom Waits as a prospector doing
really
a great
strong
performance. I think, that was very strong, but it wasn't my favorite. Which I think speaks to the quality of this whole project. I really liked the third story actually, but my favorite was the fifth. The only one that I think really didn't work was the sixth.
The third story I liked because they used Liam Neeson is a giant. They used him so well in the frame in this. He's used to great effect. Usually with actors who are that tall, the Hugo Weavings, the Elizabeth Debicki's, Liam Neeson's, they try to put them on the level playing field, literally. But here they said, this man is literally a towering visage, and we can use that to the impact of the film, both comic and incredibly serious, the very, very bleak ending.
Yeah, which is why it was nice to see the film suddenly subvert your expectations in the fourth story. And it's interesting how turns in the narrative repeated themselves and twist around. For example, something that happens in the fourth film happens again in the fifth film.
Yeah.
Since it's already happened, you know, you're not expecting to see that same kind of twist again, but when it appears the second time, it's in a very different context, a very different effect. I think
the Coen brothers sometimes...
There's so much skill in the writing.
Yeah. Sometimes the Coen brothers can sort of be too smart for their liking, and I feel cheated at times by just how they treat their audience in trying to be too clever. But I think in this film, they're appropriately clever. Like, when they're at the top of their game, they don't misjudge you and let the audience figure out things. And even when they're trying to pull one fast one over you, it's done in a manner servicing the story and actually helps you understand or surfacing something bleakness in the narrative and trying to subvert that. In this sense, they had the good sense to balance both expectations, because sometimes I feel they get caught up in their own smartness.
They have such a gift for dialogue.
Yeah.
Just, oh, the Buster Scruggs himself, that first
that
sequence.
Opening. That's really so good. It clicked to me that for opening sequence is really Looney Tunes brought to life.
Yeah.
Here's Bugs Bunny walking around addressing the camera in first person, then tricking people who come after him with guns to humiliate themselves. Yeah, violent slapstick.
It felt like an Elmer Fudd. The ending felt like Elmer Fudd. The rest of, Bugs is a perfect analogy.
Yep.
And the character actor who pulled that off, I'm just going to look up his name now.
Is it Tim Blake Nelson?
Tim Blake Nelson, yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God, incredible. What a performance.
You know
it's something you forget soon.
You know who else was incredible in this? Someone I've never heard of called Bill Heck, who played the man who falls in love with Zoe Kazan guiding the caravans along in the fifth story of the film, which is one that probably the only one that's about truly pure intentioned nice people.
Yeah.
When a lot of this film is about the dark sides of life and people who exploit each other, moral ambiguity or outright amorality, whereas this is a tragedy about forces outside of themselves affecting, you know, people who have good intentions. I think it's in keeping with a lot of the morality that the Coen brothers have put into films like A Serious Man.
I mean, the Coen brothers especially are at the top of their game when they do. I feel the smartness sometimes hides their actual talent in telling humane stories, because
they get caught up in that amoralistic world,
which is clever, but it feels once removed at times.
As I think Suburbicon did.
Oh yeah, that was terrible.
So you know where you feel like these are all characters which would coexist in this alternate universe which the Coen brothers have created, but one. They sort of merge the sensibilities of this humane characters, which you can actually meet with pure intentions, but with that zany, absurd twist and their sort of style take on it, it actually merges and becomes something way more sinister and heartfelt. Like, it becomes scarier because it's closer to life.
Yeah, I think the Coen brothers often, through their whole career, people have accused them of grotesquery and misanthropy in the way that they represent such a grotesque view on human life. And I think a lot of the time that is accurate, but the some would say nihilism of their vision can, in I think the projects that speak more to me, be put into a very humane context where there is a deep tragedy in how powerless we are with our good intentions and the way that we struggle anyway. Another film by the Coens that really touches...
Liam Neeson's storyline really, really...
Very much. And it
nailed that.
Yeah, and I think that storyline reminded me of Inside Llewyn Davis in the way that they were commenting on, you know, in that bleak winter setting as an artist continues onwards to diminishing effect.
Oh, God,
it's almost like that film condensed, a more brutal version of that film condensed down into just a very pure, simple shot. I think there's some really great moments in this film.
Oh, yeah. I have to give it to Ralph Ineson, who was in The Witch in a small role in this. Clancy Brown, who's always a superb character actor and was just absolutely wonderful.
I mean, there are six stories with six very different shades, and yet this film at no point feels stretched or, you know, when they need to end, they do end. They have a very good sense of pacing and direction.
That's right.
Which... It's amazing because there's six stories in this film.
And some of them are really just short little sketches.
Yeah,
the ones that tend to be based around a simple comedic idea.
Yeah.
The fifth one, which I mentioned before, is really a story where you get drawn into the characters and their drama. I think that's one. The fifth story is one of the best things the Coen brothers have
really
ever done.
Challenging,
a perfect shot.
Challenging to pace it because to understand those emotional beats and see, you know, which ones are short, punchy ones, and then which scenes to breathe and which story to breathe.
That's right.
And yet. Put them all together in that particular order.
Exactly.
It actually works. I mean, as a film, it works, not just an anthology.
How did we feel about the sixth story? Because I wasn't so into that.
I know, but it felt like a denouement. And after the fifth one, I felt...
You wanted some coming back down to earth time?
Yeah, like I needed that sort of release. And I felt, in a way, I'd already had that emotional high of the fifth one that I knew where it was. So I wanted a softer landing. And I felt sixth one gave me that.
It's
not the most impressive, but I felt... Because it came out of the fifth one,
I think
it was a perfect in terms of where it was in the movie.
I think the sixth one is trying to create a satisfying way of tying all of these stories together through some sort of allusions to supernatural forces. At least that's how I chose to read it. Other people might see it in a different way. To really orient it, this is a bunch of stories about death and how we deal with death and what we leave behind, who and the people we are as we die. That's what I thought that this film was orienting the film to be about that. But I didn't find that satisfying. I think it would have been better to let the first five stories just sit for themselves and get out of there quickly.
Once again, because the sixth one basically encapsulates my problem with the Coen brothers, which they fall into again and again. I mean, they tell this amazingly humane story with this quirky, zany twist in the fifth one, which is immensely scary because of the implications that it has. And then they fall into this trap of trying to be too clever again in the sixth one, trying to give a broader point, when the point that they've made with the fifth one is quite valid and quite strong in itself. Like, they should be able to trust that and let, you know, their own mastery hold, because they are pretty good and they don't need to make a point about it every now and then. And I feel that they were too much.
They know how clever they are.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, they are Buster Scruggs.
Which is insufferable sometimes, because
the misanthrope who likes to show off.
We know they're clever, but you don't need to tell us that, how clever am I? Look at me all the time.
They are hit and miss. They made some I'm Not a Bard and Fink fan, the Hudsucker Proxy.
Man, the Lady Killer is an intolerable cruelty. They made some not good at all films.
Intolerable Cruelty was not a good film. Fargo, A Brother Art Thou was mixed.
Which was not a good film, sorry?
Intolerable Cruelty was okay.
It's all right.
Okay, Catherine Zeta-Jones is incredibly hard in that movie, sorry. That's not a comment on Coen Brothers, I'm just making a point. And George Clooney Water killed, so there's some positives.
So we can watch any Catherine Zeta-Jones or George Clooney, better Catherine Zeta-Jones or George Clooney film.
George Clooney was not wearing a kilt in any of the other movies, so I think, yeah. That's like a plus, I would say, a recommendation purely based on that.
And then what were the later ones? I didn't see Burn After Reading.
It's okay.
Burn After Reading was good. I guess the point it came, it sort of reestablished what they're about.
I've really enjoyed most of the last decade since No Country for Old Men. I think it's been really strong.
Except in Suburbicon.
But Suburbicon they didn't direct. Who knows how much of that was ruined by George Clooney.
No Country for Old Men.
Who rewrote it.
Yep.
No Country for Old Men, I guess, is that perfect marriage in terms of the Javier Bardem character, which is a very Coen Brothers character kind of thing, you know, this Agent of Chaos. You know, and in this Agent of Chaos, but merging that philosophy style which they have, which is all about making a broader comment, but also rooting it into some kind of
I think the most successful
humane story
for me has been Inside Llewyn Davis, which I think is very humane and also expressing
tragic
a dark, tragic philosophical viewpoint in a less ham-fisted way than No Country for Old Men. Maybe that's a strange word to use to describe that film, but I found it almost a little bit overly oppressive in the way that it moralized to you.
I found it fun until the end when they alluded to the emergence of a very significant character in the folk movement, and that was like, okay, we know we don't need to go in that direction.
And Fargo, I mean, we don't give enough credit to it, but it basically was the antecedent to many of the other movies that came after, like Wind River, which is all about, look at what these vast expanse landscape do to people in these kind of situations and how absurd choices are made.
Fargo is a great film.
And also the TV show was really good too. So, I mean, we wouldn't have the TV show without the universe.
The TV show is okay.
Yeah. The first season was pretty good. Second season, yeah, okay.
So that is the Coen Brothers' Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It is now streaming on Netflix, as are all the films we are discussing, including Hold the Dark, which is starring Jeffrey Wright, who plays Felix Leiter in the James Bond series, as a writer who is hired by Riley Coe, who is the mother of a child who goes missing, presumably taken by wolves in the remote Alaskan wilderness, and Ursaru is about her husband, played by Alexander Skarsgård, who is soon returning from a tour of duty overseas. This takes a number of very significant dark turns. Speaking of the barren wilderness and the impact it can have on people, this is much eerier, I feel. It is closer to a lot of the Scandinavian thrillers we've seen in recent years, particularly ones Pilar Asbæk. Back in Denmark has become very well known for, and still his best work. I I don't have much to say about this film because I do want to finish watching it, but I had to stop watching this. It's not something I do with a lot of films because about two-thirds of the way in, and if you watch this or if you've seen it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, there is a distinctly violent and I feel unnecessarily violent scene. It is harrowing to watch. I feel it is not unexploitative, and it's something that I appreciate they're trying to make a broader, not unpolitical point with this, but I feel some of the carnage and the extent of the carnage they it ensued in order to make the points they wanted to make was necessary, and to a great extent at the time I watched it did turn me off this film.
Jeremy Sonnier has always been on that edge regarding violence. I think he wants to push it really far, but this was a pretty silly context to go that far with the violence, really. I don't think it's justified.
The scale of it in that zone, in that environment. Mm.
This was just a very off-putting film. If you're looking at the worst films of 2018, this would feature pretty high on that list for me.
Wow.
It was just detached. I was not interested. I was just like, why does this film exist?
The thing about that trudging, the kind of dark tone he's going for, you know, it needs to really grab you to sustain itself through, you know, just a film of pure, you know, tension and foreboding.
Yeah, the sort of atmospheric kind of eeriness, and there's
that's
nothing.
Right.
There's, and when that moment happens, I'm just like, what?
I think
like,
the issue is that it's so cold that you're not able to really latch onto a character to care about or really feel the foreboding atmosphere much. So instead, watching this film just feels like work. It's so trudgingly slow. And then you expect a great payoff from that, but it's quite silly. And it's sort of incomprehensible. You know, the important character motivations don't seem to exist in this film. It just really wants to screw with the audience, basically.
And that's part of the problem where this film just, for most of when I was watching it, it just felt like, why am I doing this to myself? Like, you know, and this is a question that you shouldn't be asking if you're actually enjoying a film or even trying to enjoy a film. Even the films that I hate watch, I at least know why I'm hate watching them.
You were watching it because we asked you to watch a bunch of Netflix movies. So we'll...
And, you know, I watched this because...
The Grudge. Well,
I didn't actually know anything about this film before it was released, and I just saw it came off my recommendations. It's like Alexander Skarsgård, Riley Coe. All right, I'll give it a go. Why not?
The only good thing I could think about this film was like, you know, a bunch of directors come together for a director's roundtable, and they're like, you know, who's made the worst film? And this director could go, hold my beer instead of hold the dark, and then that's what it did. That's the level of not
on that
the,
note,
you.
Moving on.
That's the cleverest thing about this movie, by the way.
That's not in.
So that is Hold the Dark. It is now streaming on Netflix. The next thing we are talking about is The Sinner Season 2, which recently
released.
Is
that released. A film?
It is not a film. It's a TV series.
Okay.
It's a very good
TV series.
I
didn't know we could do TV series because I wanted to talk about some TV series too then.
We talked about The Sinner Season 1 earlier in the end, The Crown, and Black Mirror, the best thing on TV right now.
You got me there, Mr. Falcon Screen.
So the screens can do TV too. So yes, The Sinner. So this is one of the best new shows on TV. It is starring President Bill Pullman as Detective Harry Ambrose, who in both seasons now has taken on a case that is very seemingly open and shut. In the first frames of the season, we see a crime being committed, and we left in little doubt as to who did it and the manner in which it was committed. In this, he goes back to his hometown, where it involves predominantly a focus on a young boy who is the main suspect in a double homicide and what appears to be a cult in which he has spent a large portion of his life. Now, this series is good, and it presents itself as trashy with inevitable conclusions, but quite cleverly subverts them. Jessica Biel, who was the mainstay of the first series as Cara Tinetti, here returning executive producer. I think her role was emblematic of this, and I think we see a lot of those elements returning here. I think also where it cleverly subverts expectations is that in every type of series, in every detective thriller, you look for a bad person, look for bad people, and there's an instinct to do so, and they deal with that quite well. Carrie Coon is the mainstay of this series. We talked about her a couple of weeks ago in Widows and The Avengers, where she played Prox for Midnight. She gets a lot more time to shine in this, and she is really good. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more from her in years to come. where the season does let itself down is that the ending is going for Broadchurch Season 1 Levels of Transcendence. And when I say Broadchurch Season 1, I still hold this up as the modern standard for this type of drama and mystery, where you have a small town, a group of people who are invariably all affected by the denouement once it occurs. There is a revelation that attempts to be on that level. However, it is the emotional resonance has to be mirrored and reflected in the hands of Natalie Paul's character, the other detective who is working on the case. And unfortunately, she is not quite on the caliber of many of the other co-stars. Therefore, it doesn't have the impact on Broadchurch as Broadchurch did. It was quickly what they're going for. Simply, so Broadchurch, when it came to, usually when you have these very emotional scenes, they shy away. They suggest Broadchurch took the level of actually showing us those confrontations. The Sinner did not, to a great extent, and that's always very disappointing. Also, the last thing I'll say on that is there's a very hackneyed plot contrivance later in the series, which sees a character removed out of the picture when I think we wanted to know a bit more about them. Otherwise, it's still a very good season, one I'd recommend checking out. Definitely see the first season first. I think it is still the standout of the two. That is The Sinner Season 2, which is now streaming on Netflix. The next thing we are talking about is Shirkers.
Shirkers is a documentary film made by Sandy Tan, who was part of a group of filmmakers in the turned to from the 80s to the 90s in Singapore, or really a group of teenagers who put their dreams to become filmmakers into reality. And it is a film that opens up with a huge amount of energy that I think really captures what it's like to be a teenager who hasn't yet come to believe that your dreams are, you know, unattainable. It's really, I think it has a really propulsive style, and it's about the energy of youth. It captures a turning point in independent film culture where suddenly getting your stuff out there onto the big screen started to seem possible in the wake of the success of people like Jim Jarmusch, who there's lots of references to, or David Lynch, or Kevin Smith. And it also covers, I think, really what interestingly and well, the historical context of the 80s and then the 90s in Singapore, a changing world as their economy grew and grew and grew, as well as the repressive cultural context of Singapore. So what I'm trying to say is that this is a film that covers a huge amount of ground. It turns into a mystery because this film that is such an interesting time capsule of so much was not able to be released. And so the rest of the film, after this section explaining how the original production of Shirkers came to be, becomes a mystery as Sandy Tan, with the eyes of an adult, looks at what happened and the aftermath of the failure of this dream to come to fruition and how that's shaped her life and the lives of her friends. I think this is one of the most thematically rich documentaries of the year, but I found the early history of Singapore and of the independent filmmaking scene and the original production that this group of teenagers embarked upon to be the most interesting aspect of the film. I feel like I understand that this film is made from the perspective of Sandy Tan after 25 years since she embarked on the production of Shirkers, and the intervening years are, of course, going to be given a huge amount of importance. But I felt like I grasped where the film was moving with that fairly quickly, and I would rather more time have been spent on the creation of the film. But I can see a lot of people disagreeing with me there. It's not as if the film gets in less thematically interesting direction. It becomes about examining a mysterious person, and so maybe there's a bit less of the humanity of telling stories about people you really know that informs the early part of the film. But nonetheless, I really recommend it, especially if you have an interest in filmmaking. I think it captures the energy that informs passionate filmmaking, and the point in a lot of people's lives where everything seems possible really vividly. One of the best things on Netflix right now, for sure.
I think this is the first thing I'd be watching on Netflix based on your recommendation. Most of the buzz I've heard about it, that is streaming now. We're going to be back on the podcast talking all things Mowgli, Cam, and The Other Side of the Wind. I want to thank you all for tuning in and joining us in a year of film with Film Fight Club. You can subscribe on iTunes and Spotify, and we'll be back next year talking best and worst of 2018 Oscar season. It started to heat up, a lot of speculation, but it's been a wonderful, well, I guess we got this podcast, but it's been wonderful you're talking movies and spending it together with both yourselves and everyone out there. And
it's always a pleasure.
It's been, yeah.
Surprisingly, for a cynical person like me, I quite enjoyed it.
It's been fun. Chris, we're just going to sit around like by a place like after this, just like talking as if this radio is not recording anything.
I love you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, sort of.
that really sums up our dynamic, doesn't it? I love you guys, sort of.
We will be more fighting back next year, we promise. This has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, Bradley Roo. Stay tuned for the podcast if you're listening. Enjoy movies. Good night.
We promise to break our promises. Merry Christmas.
And we are back on the Film Fight Club podcast. I do love you guys. It's been fun this year, and we're gonna have more films to fight about.
More fun.
I mean, isn't it amazing as men to profess our love on the radio?
Is it? Was it?
We're actually not recording this in the same room. We can't stand each other, so we record in separate booths in separate locations. I mean, I'm in Macquarie Studio right now. Damn it! Okay.
Everyone has to feel the love in the same room and think that we actually are. There together.
We actually are.
It's okay. You're in Macquarie though. It's too far away. It's okay. It's far enough for me.
Table here. So yes, we are doing a Netflix special, and the next one we are talking about is one Virat has caught, which is Mowgli, which is not the Jungle Book, which premiered a couple of years ago, though it seems to be based on the exact same source material and telling, if not the exact same story. Is that unfair?
No, that's not. I mean, I thought about this quite a lot as to what's the purpose of this movie. Like, why does this exist? Do we need another Jungle Book version or another hot take on the Mowgli narrative? And why did Andy Serkis just decide to make this? And I'm still, after watching the entire film, not come to any conclusion as to why this even exists.
It's a big jump from what was the film he made about with Andrew Garfield and Claire Foyle about the polio in early 20th century Britain.
I don't know. Probably something, you know. Andy Serkis loves to tell stories about the third world and how it's impoverished and so on and so forth.
Britain's not the third world. Only 19th century Britain is not. 20th century Britain's not the third
world.
There
is polio and there's impoverished people there. So Mowgli does follow that template in some sense. But I'm just thinking, because, okay, the intent of this movie was Serkis wants to tell a story about the Kipling stories, but closer to the source material, which was a lot darker, and he feels that the stories that have come before it have made it more kid-friendly. So he's basically trying to tell a more gritty origin story of the Mowgli narrative.
Does Mowgli need a gritty origin story?
And that's the question that actually is the most important one. I mean, who is this film targeted for? Do we really need a Batman Begins kind of origin, Nolan-esque?
Okay, now you're selling it to me, I gotta tell you.
No, that's the thing. Do we need that for Mowgli? You know, does he need to become...
Does he go away for 7 years to train with, like, ninjas and then come back?
You'll be surprised.
Oh,
because
no.
Because there is a training montage with Bagheera, who is played by Christian Bale as a voice motion capture.
No.
So it does come full circle in that sense.
I didn't see this film.
These Batman parallels are actually not... The Nolan Batman film parallels are actually not that far-fetched, because that's the tone Serkis is actually going for. He actually does think he's telling an origin story about this man-cub who will become a legend. And surprisingly enough, Mowgli is promoted as Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle. That's the full title of this film. So I'm not saying that he does actually is going for that template, the superhero template, in dark, gritty origin superhero story, and Mowgli is going to be that superhero.
Why do we want this?
That's what I'm thinking. And Bale as his sort of older mentor is Bagheera the Panther. And we have Benedict Cumberbatch playing the crippled Bengal tiger Shere Khan. We have Cate Blanchett, who plays Scar the Python with the hiss. And
Scott Hansen was so good in that role, I've got to say.
And she's barely in it, though.
And we have Andy Serkis himself playing Baloo the Bear.
I mean, Baloo. There was no singing, was
yeah,
there? There was no singing.
Exactly.
In the
movie.
I don't know. No Gary Shandling.
When you have Bill Murray, why would you need Andy Serkis? I mean, Bill Murray would have been the perfect Baloo. But that's the thing. I mean, and Andy Serkis is a great, physical performer. I get it. He loves motion capture. I mean, he truly does love motion capture. And if you've seen behind the scenes,
this, so we had to give him full credit, full credit for that.
Exactly, like for Planet of the Apes and how he's able to turn. And I get it. Like, he loves the thing. And Benedict Cumberbatch loves the thing. You know, he really did become...
The behind-the-scenes footage of this film was quite great.
Yeah.
As he was as Smaug.
Smaug. Yeah. And, you know, so that's the thing. Actually, if you were to watch... I would recommend watching the behind-the-scenes footage of this film, because that's way more entertaining than this actual film, because throughout this attempted, gritty superhero template of Mowgli, of all people, I was continuously thinking, why do we need this? And this is not a question that I should be asking.
Whenever I hear The Jungle Book and how Mowgli and the wolves story, I think of Rocco's Modern Life and how Heifer was actually adopted by wolves and didn't know he was adopted. And Rocco just drops it and he's like, was I adopted? And they will just say, Heifer, don't you think it was strange that you were raised by wolves? And that's kind of how I feel about adaptations of The Jungle Book.
But even then, I mean, this is the story trying to tell these gritty philosophical takes about, you know, where do men come from and, you know, them destroying the animal kingdom and the balance of life and power. Except that's fine in small doses and you're missing the point of the film. This film is still very much a fable. It's not a philosophically gritty take on Mowgli, the superhero who's somehow needs his Alfred in the form of Bagheera the Panther, played by Christian Bale. I mean, it's just too much for me to, like, what is this film going for? I don't know.
It's a precursor to the remake of The Lion King, and it is a remake.
No, but, like, it sets up Mowgli as a sort of, like, you know, for the second part where he can be the king of the jungle and then really, you know, fight crime, essentially, in the jungle. So essentially he becomes a vigilante superhero of his own kingdom, a.k.a. literally the Batman, you know. So it's not that surprising. And actually, we don't need a Nolan... We don't need a Mowgli imagined by Nolan.
We don't need another Nolan.
It's too close, and it's just... We don't need a Dark Knight. We don't need a Dark Mowgli. I don't know.
Okay, so for...
Mowgli's pretty dark already, like, you know, in skin tone and tone.
So Mowgli Begins is now streaming on Netflix. What is also streaming on Netflix is the new Blumhouse thriller Cam, which had its Australian premiere at the Adelaide Film Festival and is now streaming over on Netflix. It is starring Madeline Brewer, who people might know from The Handmaid's Tale. She has a key role in the series, and she plays Alice, who plays in turn a cam girl called Lola. Her identity stolen, she's locked out of her account, and then imitated by an exact lookalike in the worst nightmare, one of the worst nightmares for persons in this profession. Now, this film plays well in our fears of the disconnected, being locked out, and of, you know, that... and the dissonance of being, oh, I can't access my Facebook with this, because obviously this is a very extreme version of that. It is a psychological thriller, and a lot of it is down to Brewer, who is great in the multiple roles she plays. This opens really well. As we are a viewer, we are situated in her world. We are situated in the position of the many who watch her day to day. This film has been praised for being more accurate than many other accounts of persons who are cam girls, and it is also for being, I think, and fairly so, empathetic and showing the situations many people in this profession will find themselves in, including police hitting on them rather than helping her out when she desperately needed help. It also shows her as a normal person, a regular person, balancing her everyday life, her family life, and in this case, hiding her profession from her mother. I really liked the beginning of this film. I think it set itself up really well. And as I said, Brewer is very good in this role. I think we're going to see many things from her to come. The ending, however, greatly, greatly lets this film down. There's not a real explanation for the foe or how the phenomenon that has affected others and has been an impact more broadly that is desperately needed. Characters introduced as necessary to forward the plot and then leave very, very quickly. The inclusion is mostly inexplicable and seems to be making a comment about the superficiality of Alice's work, which is one arguable dimension of the broader issues at play here. There are many dimensions which are introduced in the beginning of this film and which do not get explored as a part of the conclusion. I think it is still worth seeing regardless for an actress, Madeline Brewer, who is certainly going places, and that is streaming on Netflix now. The last film we are talking about and the last Netflix release we'll be chatting is The Other Side of the Wind, the very, very tardy release from one of the most renowned directors of all time.
I honestly think I need to give this film another shot. This is such a dense film. It's basically a constant barrage of conversation with a hyperkinetic editing style that precedes and I think directly inspired, based on reports, Oliver Stone, with the style he employed in films like Natural Born Killers. It's constantly changing from different sorts of film stocks, cutting from different angles really furiously. It's a film I admire a lot because it's clearly breaking new ground with its technique. This, I think, is the first ever found footage film. But and the film sometimes is a little bit too on the nose in the way that it tries to justify and address why there's all these cameras all over the place filming people. But it's unexplored territory, so I can forgive it for being a little rough in that department. It's about a camera crew coming to film a veteran macho director described as the Ernest Hemingway of filmmaking on his birthday party / premiere party for his new film, The Other Side of the Wind. Virat, what did you think of it?
Honestly, and I'm probably going to admit this firsthand, I wasn't in the right frame of mind.
I wasn't in the right frame of mind for this.
Yeah, so...
it feels difficult to talk about, honestly.
It's difficult to talk about. But it's interesting to compare this with Shirkers, because in some sense they're both dealing with the ethics of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And what makes, you know, a good film and the right way to make a film. And they're both talking about the filmmaking as a process and an art. And in that sense, also a nice comparative piece to Godard's The Image Book in the way that's hyperkinetic style of and how it... But I was prepared for what I was going in for before The Image Book.
Orson Welles was so ahead of his time here. This is such a challenging film to watch. And it's hard work when it begins.
And then just... especially on Netflix. And I feel... This is, I think, more important to discuss, especially when there's so much mediocre content on Netflix.
I don't think many people will watch this on Netflix. It's a strange one for them to promote because I think a lot of people will give up early. There's a lot to admire in this. The editing, even though I find it really overwhelming, sometimes it's incredible, especially with regard to the film within the film. Which is, I think, a parody of Antonioni, particularly Zabriskie Point. Yeah. But it's actually beautifully shot. Striking editing. I think the creativity and the fluidity that Orson Welles could show when he's in a more kind of traditional style of filmmaking is in great form here. I think with this film, he's sort of saying, see, I could make, you know, another... a youth culture film like Easy Driver, Easy Rider or Zabriskie Point, but you know, I don't want to. There is a kind of a sense of bitterness about the state that Orson Welles' career was in seeping through this. So I found it quite cold and detached.
It's also at some point.
There's a lot of energy, but it's also directed in a place that isn't, you know, there's not much empathy or warmth.
Yeah, there's not much love for cinema. I mean, this is basically a film that shows off... It'll be a great study for film students to see all you can do.
It's about being
a film medium.
Yeah, exactly. But without the passionate love behind, you know, that's why comparison to Shirkers is interesting, because Shirkers is about people at the dawn of their careers seeing unlimited possibility, and Orson Welles is discovering rich new veins of cinema to mine, but it seems... You know, almost like he has a sadness about him to it. The energy that you expect to be accompanying these kinds of eureka moments was there in Citizen Kane, and we've come a long way since then.
But it's interesting with The Other Side of the Wind that Welles discovers what all you can do with the medium, but with that realization comes this resigned sadness that he can't actually... Like, he can do so much more than what he feels... The audience is going to accept,
and what he
or
feels
the
like
medium is going
he's
to allow.
Being given the chance to do,
yeah, and,
it's almost like all.
And this
you
is
know,
actually,
you can feel
I guess,
the sense
a very
of lost time in this
personal
film.
Personal statement that look, can you just allow me to do more? But at the same time, that could have been a really personal indictment. But instead, it just comes across as this cold, detached, you know, bitter kind of. the accusation, which is weird.
The editors of this film were put in a difficult position because Orson Welles had edited, I think, two or three sequences from this film. And so the rest of this film was reconstructed in order trying to emulate the editing style that Orson Welles used in his own sequences, as well as following his notes for how he wanted the film to be put together. But I think just because Orson Welles had this initial plan doesn't mean he would have stuck to it completely in the making of his films, because he said that the creation of this film was all about trying to find accidents. So I think it was something that was meant to organically grow along the way. And there's some problems in here that I wonder if Orson Welles would have, maintained for if he had had the final say over the product. Like, there's a sequence when people are watching a film and you can hear characters discussing what's going on screen over it. And I felt like, I know that Orson Welles is trying to overwhelm you with the barrage of information and opinions and people talking around the movie and talking around the characters and talking around John Huston's director, Jake Hannaford. But I still felt like maybe he would have seen that this is actually too much and pared it down when it came to the actual point of editing. But instead, people have to follow Welles' template. It's difficult. The scenes that I know that he edited were by far and away the most impressive in the film.
How is it that this came about now?
Well, there have been legal and personal problems holding up the release of this for decades. Orson Welles, had problems with producers, so he shot the film in fits and starts over years. And then he didn't have access to the film to complete it. I think the rights shifted around between people. I'm not completely sure about all of the specifics, but I started watching and didn't get to complete a very interesting documentary on Netflix, which accompanied the release of this, which is called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is covering the making of what Orson Welles wanted to do and how things went wrong. I've only watched the first 20 minutes of that before this episode went to air, but I'd like to catch the rest of it because it seems actually very interesting.
I might actually try to catch that before I watch The Other Side of the Wind.
I think you'd actually get a lot out of it that way, because especially for people who aren't Orson Welles experts. From what I can see, this documentary is really contextualizing it well in terms of what it means within his career and the time and place that it was made.
No, it's interesting to see, how little we've come from that kind of thing about empowering directors and how much directors have a say in terms of their final product. I mean, even directors today face similar problems in terms of the final product that they're actually intending to put out.
But earlier in this episode, we bemoaned the fact that George Clooney had such creative control of Suburbicon, and we've historically bemoaned the control of George Lucas over the Star Wars
prequels. Orson Welles is someone who was screwed over in away from making films that I think would have been far better if he had been trusted. He's one of those people who deserve the trust. But The Magnificent Ambersons feels too short and famously had an hour cut from it by the studio, which is destroyed and has never been able to be restored. Touch of Evil was released in a mangled form, and with the restoration that was made in 1998, we can see that Orson Welles' version is definitely far superior. So I can understand this guy being frustrated with some of the turns that his career had had.
Which is why I think the comparison with Godard is actually very interesting.
And it's definitely there's some...
Because the late Godard, and one of the most striking things about late Godard is that he is somehow able to have complete creative control over his work, and he almost just doesn't care.
He scaled down his production, but Orson Welles here is almost trying to make a huge film that's dense, but on a tiny budget. It is definitely a post-Godard film with the kind of like the hyper-editing and the inserts and the text on screen and commenting on film within a film. Extremely postmodern.
Because I do feel even in their personalities and how they approach cinema and how they became increasingly acerbic and bitter personalities also mirror Godard and Welles.
It probably mirrors the way that a lot of artists feel.
Yeah.
And their journey.
Because Godard is now seen as this kind of reclusive... person with a bitter tongue and an acerbic mind who people can't get to. And in this beautiful film with Agnes Varda, Faces Places, where Agnes Varda is trying to meet Godard and he doesn't agree to meet her, but leaves a note, which is not the nicest note in the world, even though they've been good friends for I don't know how long. So it's interesting to see how Godard is almost the last bastion of this kind of generation of filmmakers who truly...
Well, as we spoke about last week, Nicholas Roeg and Bernardo Bertolucci have died. You know, the masters of cinema are dropping off, you know, one by one by one. The people who were really there through the golden ages of the medium.
Scorsese bemoans that, you know, that filmmaking is never going to be the same. And let's see what The Irishman brings up on...
Scorsese's still doing...
On Netflix.
Yeah,
so
it's strange.
Let's see how that's going to turn out as well.
It's a strange time for cinema. It's what a strange time for an Orson Welles film to come back to us.
But in a way, it makes sense.
When we're compacting films.
Yes, that's right.
When films are meant to be... can be packaged, but are meant to be seen or adaptable to any device or any format or viewing where they should. And I mean, what I admire about Roma so much is that Coron, knowing that it would probably be seen on small screens and even on mobile phones, still made it to be seen on as big screen as possible and strove for that.
I mean, this brings us to probably one of the first discussions we had, which became the genesis of the show. And I remember talking to you and Chris, I mean, at the film festival or even before that. And when I saw you in the corner typing away, it was one of the first things I said when I met you, Glenn, about what is the purpose of cinema today? I mean, is it to create spectacle or is it to create niche kind of targeted filmmaking that people can watch in their own in the comfort of their own home?
Well,
I mean, what is
the other side of the wind being on Netflix is so interesting because it is really a film that is made at this transitional point in the 1970s, and it's asking what is the place of cinema going forward? Where's the place for the old guys and the classicism, or are things really being shaken up by new blood and new approaches to cinema? And so strange that now people are going to, when this film is finally released, people are watching it on their phones or in fits and starts. Like it really makes you think about how the place of cinema is constantly shifting.
But here's the thing. Now that Netflix have seemingly and or inevitably will win the ideological war with the, you know, with the fraternity of French critics and industry liaisons who back Khan, and they're now saying, oh, actually, it is in our commercial interests, and we like the fact that films like Roma are gaining a broader cinematic release.
Has there been some development in that? I didn't hear.
Simply by virtue of having Roma and getting the Oscar buzz.
Roma they're releasing in international territories as a semantic release.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's Netflix going to be, oh, like, if people want to see it on the big screen, here are opportunities. Oh, by the way, you come to the screening, maybe you should sign up to a Netflix account. Yeah. That's what they're going to do. Mm. And you're going to have opportunities to see these on the big screen. People are going to seek out opportunities, the wills, as we said earlier, the world, to see these on as big screen as possible.
But honestly... The one problem I do have, and I'm going to use the Filmstruck example for that, is when we trust studios like Netflix or, you know, Time Warner or Amazon or whatever to have control over the movie choices, they are not sure whether they actually do care about the cinematic medium as much as, you know, what's the algorithm going to recommend for these people, and they're going to produce as much... You know, we're going to have 10 of those Kissing Boots movies versus one of Roma. Are we happy with that progression and one of The Irishman versus... And this is going to get buried in whatever because it's going to recommend what's more popular and what kind of movies you watch. So we're going to have a dedicated cinephile niche audience who only watches The Other Side of the Wind. And maybe then they'll get recommended...
There's two other sides. Number one, people will discover new interesting films they would never otherwise be able to see. And secondly, the fact is that we talk about it as if, and we do, we're in a position where we have access to festivals like the Sydney Film Festival. I just did a trip through regional Australia. I was away for 2 weeks. And I can tell you, the communities I visited do not have access to cinema. Some do, most don't. And they will have access the same time we do to all these films. This is reaching new audiences and distinct, very new audiences in a way cinema has not been able to hitherto do. And that's hugely significant.
I just wish that the amount of films that the streaming services held were much larger, honestly. To me, the streaming service won't be a great replacement for video stores until it has pretty much everything. You know, I want to be able to log on to Netflix and type in a film from 1934 and find it.
Yeah,
I want the, you know, the vaults of studios' archive collections to just flood a single or you know, every service, and you know, instead of a limited selection and competition between the so you need to have multiple subscriptions to multiple services if you're a cinephile.
Yes.
I think, yeah.
Stan is doing pretty well in terms of getting a lot of old content.
Stan is good, but it could be so much better. You know, the way that contracts work, where a streaming service can have something for just 6 months or just a few years, it feels like a lot of films are just vanishing all the time. And as I don't know.
That's the one thing I do hate, and that's why I like the idea of hard copies and having Blu-rays and DVDs, which is, and I don't want to be pressured as like, this is leaving Netflix next month, to watch it before it leaves.
And I think,
I'm sorry, I'm paying for a service, so I feel like I'm not leasing it. I feel like I'm just always renting these movies.
I also think people,
I want to own it.
People don't want to, I think a lot of the time, have to look outside of the streaming service that they're already paying a subscription fee for. Yeah. So if a film isn't on Netflix or is on Stan only, I think people... People don't want to go to iTunes to rent it or subscribe to a different service.
Impractical to have like five or six different renting services, I think, per month. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like people we're giving too much power to Netflix, essentially.
It's just like Netflix is deciding what you're going to watch.
It's going to be mostly their own productions.
No one had Foxtel and Optus growing up. You either had Foxtel or Optus if you had one of those. We didn't.
Yeah. I mean, and the great thing about it, like, you know, for example, I'm willing to pay a premium price. For example, when the Criterion launched their Criterion channel, after Filmstruck closed down, they're going to launch their own service, Sangot, so we have the Criterion list saved. I'm going to pay for that. I'm happy to pay $100-$120 because I know I'm going to get that resource.
Okay, but would you subscribe to a Marvel channel? Because that's what Disney want to do.
That's the thing, you know.
And not just subscribe to Netflix.
But Disney owns Star Wars, and they own all the Marvel films, and they own
Netflix
Fox.
Are trying to establish a dominance before Disney can launch their own subscription service.
But that's the thing. Fair enough.
But Disney, I think, are going too far. Disney want a channel for all of those things. Like, you have to pay a separate fee for Star Wars, a separate fee for Disney Princess movies, a separate fee for Marvel.
It's insane to think about it, that the fact that we are talking about paying a premium price for somehow some of these modern movies which are not on the same level as some of the other.
It's going to work.
You know?
It's going to work.
I know it's going to work.
Because they have the volume, but B, it's because those are the films that our younger counterparts are going to, A, everyone want, but the kids are going to want to watch over and over and over again. The parents think, okay, if this is Frozen, I can just stream it 10 times. You don't have to rent
it. Man, doesn't it just represent like the narrowing down of the things people watch? If you're going to pay money, I need to see those Marvel films again and again and again and again. Doesn't that make you less likely to pay for other subscription services and look elsewhere?
I can't think of a Marvel film I've revisited except for the first Iron Man, Thor, the first Avengers, and Civil War.
But, I mean, man, it just seems it's like the narrowing of choices as corporatism goes further, you know, to think of people paying multiple subscription fees for different strands of content put out by one company. Man, I hate this future.
I mean, if I'm ever going to have kids, and that's not a certainty by any means because, well, it's me. You know, one of the first films I'm going to get them to watch is The Apu Trilogy by Satyajit Ray and then The Bicycle Thief. So I'm going to make sure they grow up right, at least in that regard. So, well, future kids, you know what's coming.
Are you sure you're not going to show them in Despicable Me 12?
Look,
search for more minions.
The thing is, I'm sure they're gonna cry. I'm sure they're gonna cry for that. But I'm gonna be a hard taskmaster and make sure that I drill them some basics of cinema karate, and then they can have a cheat day.
They're going to stand over you on your deathbed, and you know, as they put the pillow down on your face, they'll say, "This is because of the Apu trilogy."
Yeah. Yeah. that's definitely gonna be like a fitting end to my life.
In my house, it's gonna be James Bond and Rocky, and it's gonna be Star Wars and Star.
Just get out of here. Just
it's
leave.
A wonderful series. Great.
I mean, it's great, but like, I don't want the next generation to remember the bastion of cinema as to like, this is what we did. Yes, we had, these are fun films, but these are not films
that
I remember.
I'll be happy enough if they even remember that cinema was a thing.
But that's part of the problem, and I feel that, you know, part of the spectacle of movies for me has always been the childlike enthusiasm of like, oh my god, I didn't think this was possible in the visual
medium. You're
showing
me something I didn't expect.
Yeah, or you know, the
showmanship.
The 70mm, the 35mm,
images.
You know, the Dolby sound.
Yeah.
And just the idea that I didn't think this could work visually, or just something I would read in a book and then I'd see, I'm like, oh my god.
The visuals to be better than what you imagine when you read it.
Exactly, sometimes. But now it's all exactly how you imagine it. It's not even superseding your expectation. It's, if nothing else,
there's a dearth of imagination in Hollywood filmmaking right now.
It's all, everything is shot, reverse shot. Marvel movies are classic examples of that. And I'm just like,
but at this point, it's silly to look for anything more in Marvel films.
But if that's going to be the future, like you say,
and I haven't seen it, but the new Bumblebee film is getting a lot of traction because people are saying it's good and toned down.
I'm sure it's better than the Michael Bay films, but I doubt it's going to be that interesting to me.
Well, but
because
even,
it's just, I think that
the expectation is so low these days.
Well, Logan was an exception. Infinity War, in
but
some respects,
Logan
was too.
Logan is a decent film. We're
not
even
not
talking
that
about
amazing.
A good film.
Logan
I mean,
isn't
part of
incredibly
like,
good.
Because everything
it's decent.
Is, everything is so terrible. If
exactly.
anything is decent, it just
yeah,
automatically
like Logan,
looks
I don't
good.
Think was worth the accolades that
I'm
it
sorry.
Received.
I just feel like... Are we the same person now, Chris?
We might be.
We might like be. Same person.
Well, I'm hoping for next year our review of Infinity War Endgame, the new trailer's out. Endgame
oh God, like,
is going
I'm,
to... I just think the Taylor know, Swift song
the one thing,
is
the one
be
thing I'm really happy about is that I really hope it is the Endgame and then Marvel just has
it's
to
not.
It's not.
Reset the template and I'm just...
Spider-Man's up for at least two more films.
Oh, no, the template's worked for them. It makes them billions of dollars and so it'll stay until it stops making billions of dollars.
Yes, they'll make release movies as they will Star Wars do every
risks?
Year until long after we are all dead.
Yeah. But you know what? Actually, I think the Star Wars series will cave in on
but
itself.
But the part of that is
Solo.
Can't be too long.
Talking about Bumblebee.
That's the Old Republic.
Talking about Bumblebee, the other sort of franchise I'm thinking about is the Bond, the new Bond 25. Cary Fukunaga has roped in Damien Chazelle's DOP to shoot the new
but
Bond
we had
film.
We had Hoyte van Hoytema who shot Interstellar and Her on Spectre, and it wasn't a great film.
Okay, yeah.
Like, Spectre
you know.
Was, I think, underrated. It wasn't
but
as
Cary
good as
like,
Skyfall
at least
he's
a more competent director, so I feel like the director-DOP combination...
Oh, that's,
I
that's
wish we could have seen
way
the Danny Boyle.
Late.
I wish we could have seen the Danny Boyle one. It sounded interesting.
Oh, you see, but here's the... I don't know, because here's the thing. There's never been a director of a James Bond film who is arguably bigger than the series, or can accept more creative control, or their own creative... James Bond has always been handled by caretakers who have a very... who follow a formula, and that works. When they've diverted from that, they haven't been great films. Look at what happened with... I like Dying of the Day, but still, it wasn't one of the best films. Quantum of Solace is another good example.
No,
none
I mean
of
the,
those films
some
have as interesting auteurs behind them as Danny Boyle, though.
The two Bond films that did divert from the formula are some of my favourite Bond films, which are the two Timothy Dalton films.
I really like
really,
them.
They didn't really
they,
from the
I think they did divert. They printed a radically different Bond. And he was more humane.
It was radically different
and
from Roger
was,
Moore, but it was still classic James Bond.
It was but he was still James dealing Bond. From like actual depression, and he was dealing with issues, and he was very open about it.
Roger Moore and Sean Connery did hint at that, as did George Lazenby.
But, okay, that's campy, though. Like,
No, the end of On a Magic Secret Service, Sean Connery at the beginning of Diamonds Are Forever, Roger Moore at the beginning of For Your Eyes
I'm
Only.
I'm sorry, are you saying Diamonds Are Forever? Okay, you're thinking of Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, the beginning
Diamonds
was...
Forever.
He was rough in that. He was going... It was a direct sequel to On a Magic Secret Service. He was going after all the people who killed his wife.
There was real trauma involved in that opening.
That
was just such a classic male... macho way of dealing with trauma. It's not even dealing with trauma.
That's one element of how James Bond does deal with trauma, as he did at the beginning of Quantum of Solace and the end of that film, and many more to come, to be sure. We've gone a little bit off track from Netflix, so I think we're going
to
wrap up.
No, but I think this was actually a really nice sort of wrap up to, like, what is the state of cinema? Because I think that's an important question.
What Orson Welles say?
The other side of the hope.
Hope
other side of hope.
Did you say you hope he joins us?
I hope he would join us if you like.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting one. I think Orson Welles. When you look at "They'll Love Me When I'm Dead," despite the bitterness that's coming through in "The Other Side of the Wind," the film, he shows a lot of love of just talking to people, talking about the state of the medium, talking about cinema. I think it'd be great to have him on the show.
He's an amazing orator, to be honest.
He's an incredible orator, it's true.
And also, he's just got a very warm and compassionate style of speaking. Like, he wants to carry you along. He's not someone who speaks down to you. He actually has incredible knowledge. Everyone knows that. But he's not like Hitchcock in that way, where Hitchcock is very didactic.
Yeah.
Orson Welles was very opposite. He actually tries to make you understand his perspective, where Hitchcock would just be like, look at how clever I am.
Hitchcock
Welcome to the Hitchcock
more
show.
Removed. Yeah.
We actually haven't given Hitchcock enough credence to discussion on the show.
Would you guys like to do a Hitchcock special next year?
Yes.
I'd be up for that.
Okay.
We actually haven't really talked about Hitchcock very much at all.
But we've talked about Green Fog and stuff, so actually it would be a good precursor.
That was the first time Alfred Hitchcock,
probably the most famous filmmaker of all time.
Yeah, that's right.
This is the second time.
Honestly, what even is
Hitchcock when we have David Lynch and Terrence Malick?
Exactly.
He's joking.
I am joking.
No, we're not. I mean, I'm not because we've picked our camp and we know which camp we belong in. We're loyalists, okay? We don't desert people. Especially not Lynch and Malick because they don't deserve to be deserted.
No.
So thank you,
Glenn agreed with that. Glenn agreed with the Holy Church of Malick and Lynch.
I don't think they should be deserted. I think they have strong fan bases for a reason. I just wish they'd make better films.
On that note,
thank you for joining us for another year of Film Fight Club. We'll be back in 2019 with all the shenanigans, all the films, and all the films you will love, that you will hate, and that you will ponder. Yeah.
Honestly, thank you so much for putting up with us.
Thanks for listening,
guys. I know, yeah, actually. Yeah, like, I know we don't say it enough, but we can ramble on for some time. We test your patience.
This has been one of the most rambly episodes in a while, so thanks for sticking through till the end. And, or if you skipped through to this part, I don't blame you.
Yeah. Oh, can you believe this guy? Oh, we solved that. We've discovered all those mysteries. It feels you're just going to have to rewind and listen.
Yeah, that's okay. We did solve a lot of problems in film.
We got through just fine without you. Thank you very much. No, really. Thank you for being with us. Yeah.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Music,
we love it whenever we hear it from anyone who's listened to the show and, you know, who's enjoyed it. So,
and not just our family.
Send us a message, because that's the kind of thing that keeps us doing this.
Yeah, and actually, let us know what we fight about.
We're real people, and
we really love to hear.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, thanks.
No, we're nice, warm-hearted people. We're not Hitchcock.
Speak for yourself.
We hate. Remember our new slogan. We need to stay on brand for it.
We hate. We hate. Yeah, represent. Respect.
Film Fight Club.
R-E-S-P-C-T. Anyway.
So have a wonderful night. Have a wonderful New Year. Have a wonderful Christmas. Have a wonderful holidays. Enjoy the Christmas movies.
Enjoy life.
Non-Christmas movies.
Enjoy
life.
Living. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and, actually, do something. I don't know. Do you guys do anything
else? Your homework over the summer is to write me a 10,000-word essay about how movies should best be enjoyed in your life.
Exactly.
And what place does cinema have in your life?
Hint, if you use references from Tree of Life, you'll get bonus points.
No, you won't. Not from Glenn.
From Virat and Chris, yes. Use Eddie Malick references, but yeah. Do that essay. Do life. Live life.
Do life. Live life.
Choose life.
Choose life.
On the subject of Danny Boyle.
Good night.
Yeah. Love. Bye.